the method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to Unsigned Methods with me, Lachlan Bloom.
And me, Jamie Batchin.
For those of you listening to the podcast for the first time, this is part of a series where we talk to fellow writers about their process and technique.
This month's guest is the writer John McGregor, who is the author of If Nobody Speaks Remarkable Things, So Many Ways to Begin, Even the Dogs, Reservoir 13, and the book that he's publishing on the 29th of April this year, Lean, Fall, Stand.
We talked to John about his editing process and his writing process, and then hijacked the podcast to talk about aphasia, which is one of the key themes in his new novel, and is quite fascinating, I think, for most writers, in that it's a illness that affects your ability to comprehend or use language. So it obviously plays quite an important role in the writing and reading process.
Yeah, indeed. John also gave us a bit of insight into his writing in residence in Antarctica, so a bit of time spent in the polar region, and some of the unique pressures that being a writer in residence can bring to your work. So without any further ado, John McGregor.
When did the process of writing your latest book start?
I mean, really, I started back in 2004 when I went on a writing residency to Antarctica with the British Antarctic Survey and Arts Council. And I've been going around telling people that this book's taken me 17 years to write, but that it's basically nonsense because I've spent, I guess, 14 years kind of taking lots of notes out of a box and looking at them in desperation and putting them back again and writing some other books instead. So it's probably realistically been the last 3 years that I've been working on this solidly.
How did that balance work then? If we can sort of focus on the latest book, but think about the fact that you had three novels that you brought out in the intervening period. Were you working on them while compiling notes, knowing it was for something else, or did you have to decide as you were picking up notes where they were going to go, which work they would contribute to?
I mean, the reason it's been kind of in a box for such a long time is that, you know, I went on this writing residency more or less promising the Arts Council, who I guess paid for it, that I was going to write a novel about Antarctica. And I came back from this quite intense, strange experience, 6 weeks away, kind of stumped as to how to turn that into a novel. And so I guess there was quite a kind of busy period early on when I was kind of grinding ideas into the dust. You know, things were not working. So yeah, it was just a case of putting that in a box and working on something else entirely. There was no chance for crossover. It wasn't like I was working on my second novel and wasn't sure whether to use that material in this book or not. It was a very distinct project.
It sounds quite artificial in a way. I mean, how does that compare with the sort of genesis of other novels that clearly defined 6 week period where you go somewhere with the idea that this will be the start of a novel? There's an artificial element to it. Thinking of the other novels, what is normally the kind of way that the novel starts, or the birth of the first idea for a novel?
You're dead right. It's never normally me deciding in advance, I'm going to go to this place and get inspiration to do this thing, you know. And you quite often get offered opportunities to do things like that. And you know, it might be, can you write a short story about, I don't know, inspired by Coventry? Or can you write a short story inspired by the lyrics of the Smiths or something? And, you know, I generally say no, because that's not how creative ideas work in my experience. And I've often shied away from writing residencies for the same reason, because it is a bit artificial to decide you're going to go to Prague and write a novel about Prague. I saw an advert in the paper that said, do you want to go to Antarctica? And I was like, yes, I do. So I just had to kind of pretend that it was a valid way of going about the creative process. And it's basically not, you know. I think that's one of the reasons it's taken so long, is to kind of process what I experienced there and what I've read about Antarctica since into something that I authentically wanted to write about. Because, usually the creative process is different. It's about wandering around, thinking about imaginary people and what they're doing or not doing and making sense of that.
Was that your first time doing a residency of that, obviously of that geography, of that sort of commitment? Because it's always struck me that there's a lot of pressure associated with it. I'm sure some people write that way. But yeah, the idea that at the end of it, you need to have come up with something seems like a lot of pressure.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it was pretty much the first and pretty much the last time I've done something like that. I've been on a residency before that was very open. It was just, here's a nice room and a nice house and you can spend some time writing. And there was no kind of requirement beyond that. But often, I think, I guess just because of the way these things are funded, there's a kind of a requirement to produce something, you know, kind of sing for your supper. And sometimes that takes the form of running classes or workshops. And sometimes it's like, yeah, publish something about, is often related to the place where the residency takes place.
Was there much follow-up from the Arts Council? Were you sort of getting emails, it's been a decade, where is this, this book going? Or was it more your own pressure that you felt you had to deliver something?
I think, in a way, I left it long enough that I would have got away with never never doing it. I knew what I was getting myself into, and I knew that I wasn't going to just come out the other side and write a novel in 6 months. And so my application was full of kind of me hedging my bets, saying basically in a slightly pompous way, you cannot predict the creative process, blah, blah, blah. You know, and I was quite careful not to promise a novel or a book of stories or whatever. Mm. And I did quite quickly afterwards, like I published a piece in the Guardian magazine, a nonfiction piece, did a couple of little bits on radio. I sent a version of what would now be called an email newsletter, but kind of before email newsletters had been invented. So I had 100 email addresses and I sent out this email every day while I was there. So I kind of ticked some boxes.
Did you find each day you could produce anything?
I was taking a lot of notes. The main thing that was difficult was that almost as soon as I got there, I was like, well, there's a ton of interesting stuff happening here. Like, it's an incredible place physically and with all these people who are doing crazy science stuff. Some of them are quite interesting, some of them are quite weird. It just felt like a non-fiction environment, you know. It seemed absurd and artificial to take a really interesting experience and fictionalize it for no other reason than that I think of myself as a fiction writer, you know. So I was taking a lot of notes, but they didn't feel like anything that I could. It seemed really odd to just take those notes and translate them into fiction, and that was where I got stuck. Really,
the work of yours that I'm most familiar with should be your first published novel and Reservoir 13. Sort of formally quite innovative and not laid out in a conventional way, in quite different ways. So I wonder if from the notes and from the idea that it would be an environment that was more suited to non-fiction, perhaps you were sort of well placed to find a way of eventually marshalling those notes into something.
Well, I basically realized some point while I was trying to turn it into fiction was, and this was something I'd already registered in all the reading that I'd done about Antarctica. I mean, the two things that are really striking when you read a lot of the writing that's come out of Antarctica, and one of them is that it's incredibly male and male in all of the negative associations with male, you know, kind of self-aggrandizing, heroic, you know, essentially colonial, a lot of talk about untouched territory and virgin territory and you know, men thinking that they're being entirely self-sufficient when in actual fact they're huge logistical operations. So that's one thing. The other thing is that a lot of the physical descriptions in writing about Antarctica are A, incredibly ineffective, and B, incredibly boring. And it's because, I mean, I kept coming back to this, the idea of the iceberg. Especially in kind of early 20th century Antarctic writing, you get pages and pages of people trying to describe icebergs and failing miserably. And when you see an iceberg in real life, as I have, it's incredible. And it's really, really difficult to describe. And even seeing photographs of them don't really do justice to them. And the whole landscape is so other and so alien to our experience of landscape and so blank and empty that it's essentially impossible to describe. And I kept kind of coming up against that and thinking, oh, well, I'm just not, you know, I just need to try harder. But there's something about it that is so detached from the experience of most of the people who will be reading this work that you can't rely on any kind of experience or signifiers or associations. So I discovered eventually that my problem was I couldn't describe this place that I'd been to. that brought me to the idea of the failure of language. And so the book is essentially about the failure of language rather than about Antarctica.
Sounds like you tried quite a few angles before you finally sort of hit on the one that showed a path through to finishing the novel. Does that approach sort of tie in with your other writing, that you would generally, you know, start and try lots of different route stuff, different styles, voices, and it's only after a period, maybe not 17 years, but a period, that you come to the right one? Or would you normally tend to sort of start with the kernel of an idea that you're kind of itching to get down on the page, and it all kind of flows naturally from there, rather than a testing process?
I mean, I kind of both of those things. I think I always tend to start off with an arresting image or moment or kind of voice, and assume that I'm going to sit down and it's all going to flow and pour out and then kind of grind to a halt fairly quickly. And I think I tend to always forget by the time I've finished a novel how many false starts and dead ends and kind of restructurings there were. And it has actually tended to be quite a long process of getting about a third of the way through a project and then ripping it up and starting again and constantly trying to find the structure that will allow me to finish it and the voice that will be interesting enough to allow me to finish it. And I guess that did happen here. And yeah, I mean the book, really only the first third of the book is set in Antarctica, and everything else happens back at home. And that was what allowed me to finish it, really, was that kind of turning my back on it.
Okay, so with the decisions that you have to make while you're bringing the book together and the sort of false starts, if we could talk about If Nobody Speaks, Remarkable Things. For something like that, where there is, if you say you had an image or something that brought you to it, and there's obviously an event in that book that's held off and lots of different viewpoints. Mm-hmm. How much planning then did you go into, and when did you decide that was the right track to take to have that sort of structure?
Okay, so with the caveat that we're talking about 20 years ago.
Yes, I thought that would mean that there's enough time that you're happy to, you've sort of settled in your mind perhaps exactly how it came. Yeah, I appreciate that might also mean you've forgotten a lot of the false starts.
I've partly forgotten. I know that the two kind of starting images for me with that book was the idea of it all taking place on the day that Diana died, and the idea that it would all hinge around the incident to which you refer, you know, kind of tragic incident. Mm-hmm. And I knew that I wanted to be about that street and the people in those street and in that street and the way that they were connected or not connected to each other. And that was all fairly clear. And I vaguely remember kind of, you know, I tried to set it all within the kind of 10 seconds of the incident taking place, or I tried to set it all. I think those were the two things I tried, like mm-hmm. everything within a few seconds and then everything across the day.
And you knew that quite early on, did you? That was...
I knew that quite early on. The thing that enabled me to finish the book, the thing that gave it some structure, was the parallel narrative, you know, with the chapters alternating between that one day on the street and then the narrator looking back at that day from the perspective of a few years later and her pregnancy. And yeah, it was a similar thing. You know, I'd had all these ideas about what would happen in the street and that one day, and it was, the narrative was just kind of chuntering along through the day, and there was no kind of ballast to it. And setting up the structure of the alternating chapters and coming up with quite kind of strict rules for myself about how long those chapters would be and what we would see or not see, that was the kind of scaffolding that enabled me to finish writing it.
And did that mean that you had to do a lot of planning? And did you sketch things out structurally on a big sheet of paper or on post-it notes or anything like that?
With that one, not really. I drew a map of the street quite early on, and I feel like I kind of was brainstorming different characters kind of as I went along. At that point I was still writing in notebooks, and I would just be doing a thing where the main draft of what I was writing was on the page, but also ideas for what I was going to do next were kind of all over the margins and the headers. Mm-hmm. And it was quite organic, I guess, intuitive. I had no idea what I was doing. You know, I'd never been to a creative writing class. I'd never read any of the books about how people write novels. I read a lot. I knew that this was something I wanted to try doing. So I was kind of surprised. The interesting thing with that, people said, oh, it's very experimental, it's formally inventive. And I was like, oh, okay. This is just how it came out. You know, I didn't really know what I was doing at all.
So has that approach changed? I mean, I assume that approach has changed once you've done it once and you know things you didn't know before. There are different ways of approaching it. But for something like, and we don't normally speak so specifically about books, but I'm just interested because there are structures that we can investigate. With Reservoir 13, let's say.
Yeah.
Did you plan out, because that as that progresses, I don't sort of necessarily want to give too much about it away, but that it keeps visiting the same point annually, but you go through, you sort of check in on specific bits each time, every year it sort of goes through. Did you write the first chapter and essentially think, right, okay, that's the structure of it, and then you just duplicated that and each time made sure that you checked on it? Or did you know the hoops you had to jump through?
Okay, so in contrast to when I was writing If Nobody Speaks, I sort of did know what I was trying to do with Reservoir 13, and I sort of did know how I was going to go about it, and it did involve a lot of planning, not really planning, but kind of setting up structures, and it was almost kind of an analog version of some kind of coding, some kind of algorithm. I knew that I wanted it to feel like a busy book, and I knew I wanted there to be a lot of characters, a lot of landscape, a lot of time passing, weather, seasons, all of that stuff. And I basically wrote all of the text as a kind of series of raw data sets, and then I assembled compiled all of that text in the order and the rhythm that I wanted. So I you know, all of the writing basically was done out of sequence. And I came up with all these lists of, I used the number 13 as a guiding principle. So I had 13 major characters, 13 minor characters, 13 types of bird, 13 types of animal, 13 weather patterns, all of these different categories. And then within each one, I would, for example, with the 13 birds, I'd take a blackbird and write 13 passages about the blackbird. And each of those passages would be tagged to a particular month of the year, or in some cases, you know, across the span of the whole book, which is 13 years. So for some of the character storylines, their 13 passages would be kind of pegged to, you know, this story is going to take 5 years to unfold, or whatever it was. And then, having done all of that, I was able to just kind of compile it like a collage and plug things in, so that, as you were saying, you know, the there were certain things that recur. So there's always a cricket match in August. There's always a New Year's Eve fireworks. And what that did was allow me to kind of, it was really good fun, because it allowed me to spend time doing the writing and just thinking about the sentences and not worrying about structure and rhythm and pace. And then it allowed me to, while I was adding it all up together, just think about structure and rhythm and pace and not at all think about the sentences. So it took me a while to kind of land on that approach, but it was great once I got it.
And on a practical level, did you have separate sort of Word documents for, you know, a Word document for Blackbird, say, with 13 pages in it, and you chunk the text?
I mean, on a practical level, I nearly drove myself bananas. So, yeah. No, I never quite came up with a kind of elegant, efficient way of handling it. I had lots of Word documents, I had lots of printouts, I had ring binders. And when I was compiling the text, I thought I was going to, I went away for a week to a residency, actually, and I thought I was going to spread everything out on the floor and arrange it, and actually, it was like 100,000 words of text. It wasn't possible to cut it all up and arrange it. Yeah, so it was a very kind of rough, disorientating process. But I knew there was a moment when I stumbled. I think I tried doing that, and I stumbled on the tone that the book has ended up with, which is this kind of very deadpan, very like a series of non sequiturs. You know, it's just like the snow falls, Jackson has a stroke, the bird sings, the flowers grow, blah, 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 which I kind of landed on completely by mistake. And I just really liked it. I really liked the kind of the blankness of it and the relentlessness of it and the sense that time is just going to keep moving forward and time doesn't care what's happening to you. You know, the day will fin will the day will finish, the next day will begin. That's it. Like, tough shit.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, that's quite a good way, isn't it? Reflecting just the inexorable churn of time in that's to talk about in that sort of deadpan way. It happens.
Yeah. Yeah. And there was just this really nice moment where I had just put some text together and it just had that tone. I was like, oh yeah, that's what I want to do. And then kind of almost reverse engineering that to how can I sustain that across the whole book? And so that crazy process that I just described was what I developed.
And do you think that's informed how you would write in the future? I mean, obviously your latest novel had a lot of notes compiled for it, but do you think that you hit upon a good strategy working out the structure and everything first and all the information that you need behind it that then allows you to write and just think about the structure of the writing?
Sadly, not really. No. I think that process and that structure was particular to that book and that project. And simply using that same process again would result in the same book. You know, and again, it could have different characters and different landscape, but it would be the same. It would feel like the same book. And I've never been very comfortable with just writing the same thing again. And so one of the reasons that my process feels quite slow is that it just kind of starting from scratch every time.
Yes, that's interesting. So the process has to fit the work that it's going to produce. So yeah, you have to sort of reinvent it.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. It probably doesn't have to, but that's what I've always done so far. It's not a very efficient way of working.
But then I guess you've got to keep it interesting for you and got to keep, yeah, the thing that keeps you coming back to the pages.
Yeah, interesting and I guess authentic.
Captain Roald Amundsen was 38. As a boy, he had been enthralled by the exploits of polar explorers.
What appealed to me was the suffering they endured. A strange ambition burned within me to experience those same sufferings.
You said earlier that you were still using notebooks when you were writing your first novel. Literally in the sort of nuts and bolts sense, how are you, is it lots of Word documents, I think you mentioned earlier?
I haven't really settled on, for a long time I was very kind of insistently, I write in notebooks, then I type it up, then I print it out and redraft on the printouts, then I type it up again, and very kind of, yeah, very insistent on that. And that worked and it had a lot in its favor, but I've just kind of fallen out of the habit of writing longhand for long periods of time. And I'm more comfortable using a laptop and I'm more able than I was before to kind of think creatively while using a laptop. But at the same time, my laptop is full of distractions and nonsense. and so I keep trying to get back to the notebook, but it doesn't always work. It's one of those things, isn't it? Like, kind of reinventing your process is a nice way of giving yourself a bit more energy.
Mm-hmm.
So this time around, I discovered A3 paper. And I was just enjoying writing on A3 paper and kind of something about the scale of it just allows you to kind of, you write your text over here and your ideas over here and lots of diagrams and arrows. And there was just something about that was a bit quite freeing. But it's not as if I wrote the whole novel on A3 paper. I just kind of, those first ideas and the first kind of snippets of text.
Did you use any other tools for taking notes? I mean, do you still use notebooks to write notes or do you take notes on your phone or audio notes or any other tools that come into the process?
Yeah, not really. No, so when I was in Antarctica, I was just using notebooks, A5 notebooks. I mean, since then, I've never got into using audio notes. The closest I come to any kind of efficient process is emailing myself when something is interesting. Because I've just found that searching my email inbox is the most coherent way I've come up with of kind of keeping track of research information. Mm. The most kind of researchy thing I did for this book was, so what I haven't told you yet is that the book is about a guy who has a stroke while he's in Antarctica, and he comes back, and when he's recovered from the stroke, he's got a condition called aphasia, which is where your language is damaged in some way. And, you know, people have lots of different versions of aphasia. Sometimes they can't find the right word. Sometimes they talk what sounds to us like nonsense. Sometimes it affects their writing or their reading, or they can speak clearly, but they can't understand what's being said to them. There's lots of different versions of it. In order to research that, one of the things I did was go to a kind of self-help group for people who have aphasia and their partners or carers or whoever. For about a year, I was going to this group once a month and just kind of taking part in the activities they were doing in this group. Obviously, didn't make any sense for me to just sit there taking notes. You know, that would have been intrusive and would have made people feel self-conscious. And so I was just trying to kind of absorb that experience and absorb how these people were using language and how they were relating to each other, and sort of with the intention of getting home and then taking some notes. And generally I didn't. You know, generally I think it gets back to that difference between fiction and nonfiction. You know, if I was writing a nonfiction book about aphasia, then yes, I'd hurry home and I'd write down lots of notes and I'd make sure I'd have all my facts correct and would try and get the exact quotations of what people had said, get those down on paper. But actually, because I was writing fiction, I didn't want to just kind of fictionalize those particular people. I just wanted to absorb a sense of what it might be like to struggle with your communication, what it might feel like to know what you're trying to say but not be able to find the right word. And so often it's not about notes at all. It's just kind of absorbing a sense of how things are, and then when you come to write the fiction, trying to inhabit that sense that you've absorbed.
Obviously at the moment we're nobody's going too far, but in the normal process of things, if you're out and about, would you, if you saw something of interest, you wouldn't sort of reach to take a note about it. You'd think, oh, that's interesting. When I get back to my desk, you know, later today or tomorrow or whenever you're in the writing period, you remember that, but you're not looking to take notes when you're not in that writing period. Or is there a bit of overlap?
Yeah, that's tricky, isn't it? I mean, it's that funny thing, like when you're doing your taxes, you're like, what is a writing expense and what isn't a writing expense? And there is a sense in which I feel like my writing process doesn't really have an on and off switch, because when I sit down at the desk and write, I'm making use of all of my experiences, ideally. But I've never been one of those writers, and I'm kind of quite jealous of people who are like this, one of those writers who kind of just always has a notebook on them and will whip a notebook out at the slightest provocation and write down lots of things that they've heard or seen or ways of phrasing things. I was like that once. You know, when I first was dabbling my toes in writing, I did do that a lot, and it was useful. And I have kind of stopped doing that, and I don't know why. Maybe I'm lazy.
I think it's interesting, from the writers we've spoken to so far in the podcast, it does seem quite there's a big difference between some writers swear against taking any notes. They absolutely will not write anything down other than when they're writing, and they, you know, obviously absorbing it all. But for them, the whole idea of taking notes is antithetical to writing fiction. You write the fiction when you're writing the fiction, and you live. And other writers, as you say, have a notebook in the back pocket ready to take a note of the slightest interest. So I mean, it's interesting.
Yeah, I know, like the nonfiction writers that I admire, when I've read about their process, it's all about notes, and it's all about just details, and then a process of kind of compiling those notes into compelling piece of nonfiction. But yeah, I guess it goes back to what I was saying about, you know, that weirdness, the artificiality of trying to directly translate an experience into fiction. There's something that feels a bit odd about that.
I was wondering if I just ask you about the kind of participant observation stuff that you did with the group, the self-help group for people with aphasia. Have you done much of that before? And were you firstly upfront about the fact that you were a novelist going along, or did you just attend quietly? And if you were upfront about it, do you think that changed how people interacted with you?
It is a new thing for me to have done something like that. The only kind of proper research I've done before has been you're just meeting somebody and asking them questions directly. So this kind of more participatory thing was new. I was completely upfront about it, you know, and I had to kind of, I think I'd already been talking to a few like speech and language therapists about aphasia and you know, trying to get my head around it. And one of them suggested that I could go to the group. Mm-hmm. And I was quite nervous about it. And I did feel like I would be quite an intrusive presence, but you know, I explained that I was interested. I wanted to know more about aphasia. I wanted to know more about the group and that I would be using some of what I'd learned in a novel. People were just really open to that. And the thing is, aphasia is one of those conditions that is kind of weirdly underrepresented and kind of not, you know, people generally haven't heard of it. People generally don't know what it is. And so people who live with it are quite keen for people to find out about it. So I guess they were interested in the fact that I was interested. But after a couple of sessions, I just was one of the people who were there around the table, you know, and I took part in the quiz and I, you know, contributed to the conversations that were going on. And yeah, I found it a really moving experience to kind of be included in that group. And there was a point about halfway through when they asked me to kind of give a talk about the theme of the month was books, and they were all talking about books that they liked, and they asked me to talk about being a writer and what I was doing. And I had to, because one of the things when you're talking to people with aphasia is you have to think really carefully about how you're talking and how you're phrasing things, and you need to kind of use, I had to draw some kind of visual aids to explain what I was doing and think really carefully about presenting it as simply as possible.
It must be interesting going to a group like that specifically as a writer, because you're kind of the negative image of what the people there are suffering from. Like, they're having problems with finding the words, whereas you have, mm-hmm. the whole point of what you're doing is that you can choose the word and you can hone it and find exactly the right word.
In the same way, though, a writer is the probably the person that has the most difficulty finding words. There's a quite a link compared with, you know, generally non-writers. People maybe don't think about the word choice in the same way as when you're writing. It can become obsessive. Mm. And I can imagine there's a lot of actual parallels, even though obviously you're able to achieve a higher level. The feeling of not finding the right word is, well, for me anyway, as a writer, it's quite familiar. It's not something,
yeah.
You know, it's not something effortless that you always have the right word. In fact, quite often you don't. And, you know, you can spend a day looking for, you know, longer even to pick the right word. And yeah, it's fascinating the contrast, but I guess the overlap as well, potentially.
Yeah, no, there was a lot that was really fascinating about it. And it really, you know, it really tied in with this idea that I'd come away from Antarctica with about not being able to find the right words, not being able to describe things. Yeah, I mean, that was one of the difficult things. I mean, especially that day when they were kind of talking about their favorite books, because a lot of them were talking about their loss. You know, they were talking about, you know, I used to be an avid reader and now I don't read. And you know, that was kind of hard to hear. Even within the group, there's a lot of variety. You know, some of them could manage to listen to audiobooks. A couple of them could still read fine, even though their speech wasn't great. But it was quite weird. Yeah, it is quite weird knowing that most of the people in that group won't read this book.
I was assuming that it's a generative thing with speech, but it completely, obviously it's a scale and people have it in different ways, but it can just completely take language out of your life.
There are different ways that aphasia affects people, and some of that is about the kind of semantic understanding of the language within the brain. So people not being able to find the right word or get words muddled up. But then there's also phonetic difficulties where people are just saying the wrong word. They you know, they can picture a lemon in their head and they know it's called a lemon, but the word that comes out of their mouth is melon, you know, and then the therapist has to kind of work out, well, is that the sound that's wrong or is that their understanding of the word that's wrong? But then the process can be damaged the other way around, so they have difficulty understanding what's being said to them. And it was fascinating to learn about and to just think that kind of terrifying, really, to think that deeply about how language works. And
I guess it's not a neurological I mean, it is neurological in the sense that it's something to do with the brain, but it's not specific to, well, they've had damage in this specific region of the brain and this is causing this. It's more an umbrella term to describe these various symptoms related to language. Would that be right?
Yeah, kind of, except the damage is often quite specific. So, you know, if somebody has a stroke, if it's a blood clot, then that will go to a particular part of the brain and through scans they can see where that's damaged the brain, and that part of the brain is associated with a particular part of language processing. And sometimes, you know, people, there's a lot of work being done into the way that brains can recover, and a certain amount of rewiring can go on and people can redevelop their language. But yeah, it's kind of mind-boggling to get your head around how people have understood those processes inside the brain.
And a sort of broader, I mean, I imagine the people in the group, and there could be quite severe, you know, medical issues, but in a sort of broader sense, difficulties with language, you know, if you have a severe hangover, you're going to not be able to process language in the same way as you did the previous day, which is, I mean, not to compare that to people who have, you know, had serious brain damage and have serious issues, but it's not something that's just constant every day, your facility with language. And when you start thinking about how it's improved or decreased compared with last month or last year or yesterday, it's there's no answer to it, but it's a fascinating subject.
Yeah, one of the ways I found it helpful to think about was thinking about speaking in a second language, especially, you know, I don't speak a second language, but I have sometimes attempted to learn a second language, and that experience of being in a situation where you know what you want to say, you know what you want to communicate, and you can't find the right words for it, you know, and maybe you sort of know the words and you try those words, but they're not understood. And that's the closest I could come to understanding, you know, this process. Because I mean, one of the key things that I kept coming across was, you know, for the most part, people with aphasia they don't have cognitive difficulties. You know, their intelligence has not decreased, but not being able to put a name on something, not being able to communicate things, can make you feel stupid, can make you look stupid. But also at some kind of deeper level, if you can't associate language with experiences and feelings, then you're not processing them in the same way. And there's something really kind of interesting and complicated about that.
Yeah, I think you're raising the point of learning another language. My Spanish is pretty rusty by now, but I learned a bit, and I've the idea of the connection between experience and feelings and the language that you kind of formulate it in. I think it is from recalling sort of struggling to speak in certain situations, the same phrase or the same conversation can be incredibly difficult or incredibly easy depending on so many more factors than just a kind of formal logical thought process in your head, like the surroundings you're in, the company, that everything about the experience and the feelings is tied into the facility of using language and responding and having an effortless flow, which you kind of want to have to exchange a language. And yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Is that something you noticed within the group, that people in one setting they'd really struggle, and then with certain triggers or stimulus they'd be better the next week? Or
yeah, I mean, definitely. Yeah, people talked a lot about fatigue, and you know, the group met in the morning, so people were less fatigued. The meetings were relatively short. The activities had to be quite short and contained. And yeah, you could see kind of month by month, people, you know, some months people were very engaged and involved. Some months they were quite passive and quiet. So yeah, that was really clear. And then also the fascinating thing was the relationship between, you know, most people came with a partner or a carer. And those relationships and the way that the partner felt they needed to interpret or communicate on behalf of or sit back and try and facilitate it, that was really interesting as well, just from a kind of social point of view.
You said it doesn't necessarily affect their sort of cognitive abilities, or in general doesn't. Does it affect their memory and their ability to process memory? Because I don't know anything about neuroscience, but my assumption is that you can't remember things from when you're a baby, for example, because you don't have language to help you compile the memories or to associate things. Does it affect that?
I mean, bearing in mind that I am not an expert by any means, my understanding is that, for a start, stroke does affect people's memories, and stroke affects people's abilities to retain memory and to make memory. So if research has been done into this, it's probably quite difficult to disentangle those memory issues from memory issues associated with language. But yeah, I don't know, but I think it's be really interesting to look into, because intuitively that seems to make sense. If you can't put language to something, it's harder to kind of to keep hold of it, isn't it? And I know, you know, from what I know about dementia, for example, in terms of memory, people are often encouraged to talk about their day and tell stories about their day in order to try and retain those memories. That's what storytelling is, isn't it?
Moving on entirely from that, you're obviously publicising this book. Have you started work on the new project yet? And if so, what stage are you in it? What's your sort of day-to-day approach to writing?
Every single time I've published a book, I've always had the intention of being properly into a new project by the time the book comes out, so that I kind of feel a sense of momentum. And I've always kind of failed. I always get kind of tied up in the process of publication and, you know, writing stuff about the book and about the background to the book and just, you know, the cool, exciting stuff about publishing a book, worrying about the cover and thinking about how you're going to do events and all of that kind of stuff. So no, I'm not into a new project yet. I mean, I know that what I want to do next is spend some time with short stories, get my teeth back into short stories. So that's on the horizon. I think for me, usually what's happened is at some point I talk to somebody about that idea, and at some point I sign a contract about that idea. And then suddenly there's this whole other imperative. You know, like I made the mistake of telling somebody I was going to write a novel about X or Y, and they've given me some money, and so now I have to finish it. And that kind of... It's, you know, I mean, you talk about the artificiality of kind of sitting with a blank page and waiting for inspiration. The artificiality of having told somebody you were going to do this thing and then waiting for it is quite useful, really. You know, I've never really managed to stick to a deadline, but I've always found deadlines helpful.
So thank you to John for joining us remotely, I believe from Nottinghamshire. Earlier this year, and thank you for joining us and listening.
You can find us in all the usual podcast places, and do like and subscribe if you enjoyed this podcast. You can also find us on Twitter at Unsigned Methods, or on our website at unsignedmethods.co.uk. You can find me and my writing at lachlanbloom.com, or I'm on Twitter as well at lachlanbloom.
And you can find out about my writing and my novel Siphonophore at Jamie Batchin on Twitter, at Jamie_Batchin on Instagram, and my website is jamiebatchin.com. Thanks for listening, and talk to you next time.